I should have said at the beginning that we're going to run the papers one after another and then have general discussion at the end after all three papers. So I'd now like to welcome Dr. Anne Stephen to do our second talk. Anne is the senior curator at the University Art Gallery after many years of working as the curator of history and culture at the Power Museum. She's the author of Looking at Looking, The Art and Politics of Ian Byrne, and the co-author of, with Philip Godin, Andrew McNamara, of Modern Times, The Untold Story of Modernism in Australia. And she's going to talk to us today about J.W. Power's vision to bring the people of Australia in more direct touch with the latest art.
Thank you. Mine is really a slide talk, so without further ado, am I pressing which? Thank you. For 150 years, the university has been able to teach and engage the public in its scholarship thanks to the foresight of benefactors. Their collections have given students, scholars and the community access to original materials, rare objects and artworks. These collections are at the heart of the idea of a public university and one of the most visible means of diffusing knowledge. The most recent gift, the Picasso donation to be auctioned later this month, has some quite intriguing parallels with the J.W. Power bequest. Not only are both remarkable for their extraordinary scale, these gifts arrived unsolicited, catching the university totally by surprise. Curiously, the two donations also straddle the studies of medicine and the visual arts. However, that is all that can be said about the Picasso until after the auction later this month. Next year, it will be 50 years since the announcement of the Power bequest to the university to, in the words of the will, to found a Faculty of Fine Arts to make available to the people of Australia the latest ideas and theories in the plastic arts by means of lectures and teaching and the purchase of the most contemporary art of the world and by the creation of schools, lecture halls, museums and other places for the purpose of such lectures and teaching and of suitable housing the works purchased so as to bring the people of Australia in more direct touch with the latest art developments in other countries. While Power wrote his will in 1939, the university didn't even know of its existence till after his wife's death in 1961, which contributed to that fog of obscurity. As most of you would know, I'm still having a little bit of problem getting the next slide. If you could, thank you. The Power bequest was also accompanied by a further gift from his widow, Mrs. Edith Power, of over 300 of his own Cubist paintings, one of which you can see on the screen, and more than 1,000 of his graphic works and sketches. Though in this talk this afternoon, I'm not going to focus on his art as such. If interested, you can see half a dozen of his paintings in the Power Institute's Mills building. And I'm writing a series of articles in the Museum News. The latest one is just here. But my talk this evening rather explores the circumstances that shaped Power's ideas for his bequest. And I want to ask what inspired Power and why did he choose to leave the university? A gift estimated in contemporary terms to be worth something of the order of $34 million, making it among the largest individual donations ever received by the university. Next slide. When his will was announced in 1962, the idea of linking education and contemporary art was controversial, as is evident by these press clippings that reveal some of the debates that ensued about how the Power bequest was to be interpreted. At that time, very little was known about the benefactor himself. Power, despite the fact that Power had exhibited regularly in Europe during the interwar years and had authored a book on pictorial construction. Next slide, thanks. His self-portrait. While Power's grandfather was the renowned colonial architect Waddell, his grandson was a stranger to Sydney, where he was born in 1881. After graduating in Melbourne from this university in 1904, he left Australia in 1906 for good. That year, he had inherited the greater part of his fortune held in what became the Mutual Life and Citizens Assurance Company after his father's death. And in retrospect, I think it appears that he must have been desperate to escape Edwardian Sydney and the confines of his family. In London, he became a member of the Royal College of Surgeons and during the war served in the Royal Army Medical Corps and then married Edith Mary James. After the First World War, with the encouragement of his wife, he gave up medical research to study art in Paris. Thank you. Next slide. The age of 38, and you can see him here in the atelier, that man who stands with the glasses right in the background with a rather dome-like head, balding, and wearing the waistcoat. And for two decades until his death in 1943, he had a short but fascinating career as an artist. In fact, in this photograph, I'm suspicious that it's been incorrectly ascribed to another atelier, and I think, in fact, the man with the moustache between the model and the rest of the students is Fernand Léger, which makes it particularly interesting, but that has yet to be confirmed. Power's cosmopolitan existence at the centre of modernism was all but invisible in Australia. The only painting shown in Australia during his lifetime that I've found is the one that was included in the much celebrated 1939 Herald exhibition of French and British contemporary art that toured Australia during the war. Nothing more was seen to 1962. Next slide. The only substantial account of his benefaction is that by Bernice Murphy, written in 1993 when she was assistant director of the Museum of Contemporary Art, really about that institution's origins. And as many of you know, over the 1980s and 90s, the MCA controversially became the principal recipient of the Power Bequest. Murphy sees Power's patronage as being shaped by the values of 19th century colonial culture and compares his bequest to the two great Melbourne art patrons, Arthur Felton, who in 1904 established the Felton Bequest for the National Gallery of Victoria, and the newspaper man, Sir Keith Murdoch, who in 1945 endowed the Herald Chair of Fine Arts at the University of Melbourne and underwrote the 1945 Herald Show that I've mentioned before. I will not rehearse the torturous struggles over the Power Bequest that Murphy documents in great detail. Rather, I want to shift emphasis and sketch previously unmentioned international figures and movements that I believe shape Power's ideas and thinking about the public role that contemporary art might play in education. I should mention that much of this research comes from a larger project that I'm currently undertaking with the artist art historian A.D.S. Donaldson, and both of us will be co-curating an exhibition, a recreation of, in fact, Power's first solo show in Paris in 1934, next year here at the university. Next slide, thanks. During three decades as an expat, Power made only one small personal gesture that signalled his attachment to the university. In 1934, he sent from Paris to the Fisher Library a copy of his newly published book, Éléments de la construction picturale, inscribing it to the Library of Sydney University from an old student. Then he listed his medical qualifications and signed. Brussels 1934, he moved between Paris and Brussels through the 30s. Next slide. His book was conceived as a practical textbook for students, artists and designers on pictorial construction, and its very minimal and elegant cover, which I presume Power designed himself, is based upon one of the methods of squaring out a canvas, a proportion based on the square root of 2 to 1. Though Parr was quick to reassure the reader that while most old pictures contain it somewhere, it is only one of hundreds of geometric proportions and undue prominence must not be given it. Next, thanks. Parr's book emphasised continuity. For instance, the final chapter was based on an analysis of a cubist composition, which he argued doesn't differ in any way from the methods of the old masters. The only difference is that the construction is left bare, while the representative element is subdued or lost. He demonstrated this in an analysis of its proportions through a work by Juan Gris, explaining his choice in the following terms. The work of Juan Gris always repays study. It is solidly built on classical principles, and he was able to explain his attitude with such lucidity that he was invited to give lectures at the Sorbonne on cubism. Now, it's quite likely that Parr attended some of Gris' lectures as he was studying art in Paris in the 20s, and it's significant that he valued Gris as an avant-gardist who actively engaged with the Academy, an idea that is not without contradictions, as modernism was always defined against the art of the Academy. Next. There's considerable documentary evidence that Parr was very generous to his friends. The Anthony Bertram correspondence with Parr, held in the university's archives, reveals many occasions when he supported other artists and writers associated with the London group in the 20s and early 30s. These snapshots from the Bertram family album record that circle, including Parr and the painter Paul Nash. Thanks. Bertram writes of being given several paintings by Parr, and in 1927, when he was a very hard-up young writer with a new family, Parr gave him a gift of £75, a huge amount of time. Next, thanks. But what are the broader models of philanthropy in education and the visual arts that Parr would have known firsthand? Parr followed with great interest the Bauhaus educational experiments in the Weimar and Dessau, though he never visited in the 20s and 30s Germany. He also toured North America in 1937 and stayed in New York, and this is a clipping of the New York skyline that appears in one of over 50 sketchbooks held of his in the National Library of Australia. Next, thanks. He would certainly have been intimately acquainted with the Museum of Modern Art New York, the paradigmic model of a contemporary art museum that popularised educational programmes, a key product of American philanthropy from the Rockefeller Bliss and Whitney fortunes. His library, now housed at the National Library in Australia, contains many Museum of Modern Art catalogues, like this one, Cubism and Abstract Art, an exhibition that Parr himself visited, 37. Next, thanks. However, I believe it was from his immediate milieu in the cosmopolitan avant-garde circles in Paris that most contributed to his thinking about benefaction and public education. One of the most significant moments was triggered when he was invited to join Abstraction Création. Between 32 and 36, this alliance of non-objective artists included some of the most renowned international avant-gardists, and you can follow those names, the list, tiny writing I know, but starts with Arp, runs down Molinage, Kupka, extraordinary range of people, Mondrian. Also note Strzemiński, von Dozenberg. I'll be coming to Strzemiński in a little while. Parr was represented in all the issues of Abstraction Création between 1932 and 36, illustrated his work, published his writings, and in fact he held his first solo show in their Paris gallery at Wagram Avenue in 34, and that's the one that we'll recreate next year. Extraordinarily, we have most of those works. Next, thank you. A full set of these annual reviews, annotated by the artist Georges von Tongelou, one of its founders, was recently acquired by Harvard Library. It reveals in the annotations on the side, and I haven't got the details, but you can see strokes of pen on the side there, that Parr was one of the most regular contributors. On the front cover, you can see those annotations, and, you know, von Tongelou was very concerned about the debtors, and he makes various comments about them. Next, thank you. Power was in fact aligned within the organic strand of this group, as his painting used biomorphic forms, like this very witty take on the old biblical classic of Susanna and the Elders. He wrote in 1932 to his friend Bertram, "Our new review, Abstraction Création, has now appeared and is full of interesting and intelligent articles by the painters represented, but it is still a paradox to me that such intense intelligence should end in a picture of two black bars on a white ground, as it does with Elion, Mondrian, Moss and Goron." Now, while that comment indicates a pretty limited grasp of abstraction and geometric abstraction, many of these artists were in fact included in Power's own art collection, including works by Helion and Goran, which reveals another aspect of Power's philanthropic support for the group as both an artist and a collector. Thank you. Another closely related artist group, which in the early 1930s conceived of a really visionary model of contemporary art education, was the Polish movement known as AR. The acronym stood for Revolutionary Artists Real Avant-Garde. The group functioned as a crucial link between artists of Eastern and Western Europe who sought to create an awareness of international avant-garde art. Conceived by the remarkable artist couple you see here in the photo, Władysław Strzemiński and Katarina Kobro, they convinced the Department of Education and Culture of the city of Łódź, spelled L-O-D-Z, to establish a museum based on representative examples of European and Polish avant-garde art. Strzemiński, as the principal advocate of AR, argued that, in his words, museums play the most important role in artistic education. He advocated that museums should have both historic and contemporary displays, which was a pretty novel concept in the 1930s. Next. Through Strzemiński's contacts within Abstraction Création, AR received donations from many leading European artists such as Van Doesburg, Van Tongelu, and Sophie Tabarrab. AR established the International Collection of Modern Art, which opened to the public in the Polish city of Łódź in 1931. In 1932, they published a catalogue of the collection. Power would have known several of their Paris-based members because they were part of Abstraction Création. Strzemiński was also a member, and you're looking at the neoplastic room which he designed, featuring his wife's Kobro's sculptures in the foreground, which was really a didactic display. I should really ask for the lights to be turned down so you can see it, because it's really quite an extraordinary space. The museum intersects utopian ideas about a new architecture in which these kind of distill-like colours, that's okay, yeah, I can, was integrated into the room. It was in fact overpainted and dismantled in 1950, but then reconstructed in the 60s, and you can see it to this day. AR's visionary scheme to establish a contemporary museum as an educational institution was driven by the desire to overcome the isolation, next slide, of Poland in the 1930s. And this is not dissimilar to what inspired Power's vision to introduce access to the latest contemporary art in Australia. While Strzemiński and Kobro were poverty-stricken, they used their contacts and reputation as key avant-gardists to initiate the project. Power used his inheritance. And as artists, Power, Strzemiński and Kobro also chose to donate all their own art to their visionary projects. By the 1930s, thank you, next slide, Abstraction Création would itself be decimated by the rise of fascism across Europe. Many of its members were expatriates based in Paris, already driven into exile by the totalitarian regimes in Spain, Germany, Italy and Japan. Power's intimate involvement with this tragic denouement can be followed through his association with another of the artists in the group, the German Jew Otto Freundlich. He, next slide please, oh actually return to that one. He was singled out by the Third Reich when one of his early works, this work, The New Man, was notoriously featured on the front cover of its travelling exhibition, Degenerate Art. The following year, in 1938, both Freundlich and Power had solo exhibitions at Paris Galerie Jean Boucher. It appears that they were both had become by then firm friends. A letter held in the university archives, written that year by Freundlich to Power, reads, "Mon cher Power," and thanks him for votre cadeau généreux, your generous gift which has rendered me a great service. Freundlich goes on to write about taking comfort in this miserable epoch. Artists can follow their conscience, and promises to send Power one of his petit mosaic. If you could say the next slide. No doubt a bit like this one. At this stage, we know nothing of what it was that Power did for Freundlich, though as a high-profile socialist and German Jew, he was under grave threat. So late in 1938, next slide, and this is my final one, the Powers fled Paris for Jersey and the Channel Islands, imagining it to be a safe haven. It was a terrible choice, as Jersey would be occupied by the Germans in June 1940. When war was declared the year before, September 39, Freundlich, being a German citizen, was interned by the French authorities. That same month, Power wrote his will. His friend Freundlich would then later be deported to a concentration camp and died in March 1943. Power himself died 5 months later of cancer in occupied Jersey. It was these dire circumstances that must have occupied and shaped Power's vision when he wrote his will. Thus, his bequest to university might best be understood as a response to fascism and war, and really an affirmation of his belief in the humanist values of art and cosmopolitan exchange in engendering international understanding. Old-fashioned, yes, but nonetheless still visionary. Thank you.